Well, good morning. How is everybody doing? Okay. Those who are in the tents, how are you doing today? Today's kind of the day where you're like, oh man, I really miss my bed right now. So like I've always said throughout the other sessions, if you fall asleep, you need a nap, just keep taking it. If I fall asleep, I need a nap, I'll keep taking it up here. But if you have a Bible, grab it. We're in John chapter 5. John chapter 5, verses 1 to 9. We'll be there in a few minutes. Today we're continuing this series, this look at these big questions that Jesus asked of people. And we've said that it's actually in these questions, not in Jesus' answers, but in these questions that we start to discover what he wants us to do and who he's all about. And there's a question today that's almost seems absurd that he asks of people. He asks of a specific person, and it's this question: do you want to get well? Do you want to get well? And it made me wonder who, when they are sick, doesn't actually really want to be made well. But then I thought of one sickness that is a terrible, terrible illness that affects about half the world of those who are afflicted with this disease. You may know what I'm talking about. It is called the man cold. I don't know if you've ever been afflicted with the man cold. In case you're wondering what the man cold is, I recently read an article describing the stages of it, and it compared the man cold versus the mom cold. So we're going to walk through 5 days of the man cold versus the mom cold. Day one, the man cold. The man arrives home for work and drops into his recliner. Long day, asks his unsuspecting wife. I felt awful all day, the man replies. Then he adds the 6 words that strike fear into the heart of every woman. I think I'm getting a cold. Mom cold day one. The mom notices she has a scratchy throat. She lets out a quiet groan, then goes on the rest of her day. Man cold day two. The man uses an entire box of tissues due to his runny nose. He asks his wife to check his temperature 3 times. When she says he's cool as a cucumber, he snorts in disdain and insists that he has a fever. He then piles 4 blankets on top of himself to prove his point. While occasional moans signal to his wife how sick he is, her best reminders are the constant requests he makes of her: hot tea to help his sore throat, honey and lemon for his cough, a heating pad because body aches, tissues for the nonstop runny nose, another blanket because 4 isn't enough, the thermometer to check his temperature again. Look at me, I'm sweating. No, I can't take the blankets off. I'm freezing. Homemade chicken soup, but only if it's his mom's recipe. Mom cold day two. The cough continues and the cold moves into her nose as well. She puts a travel-sized pack of tissues in her purse and goes about the rest of her day. Man cold day three. The man only survived the night thanks to the grace of God and the modern marvel that is NyQuil. It only makes sense to take a sick day because getting out of bed will surely result in immediate death. Even staying in bed, he's pretty sure his odds aren't good. He spends his day alternating between hallucinatory sleep, wishing his wife was there to take care of his every need, and crawling, literally walking is out of the question, to the kitchen for sustenance and more drugs. Mom called day three. The alarm goes off after a sleepless night, and she fleetingly entertains the idea of calling into work so she can stay in bed. Then she remembers the project that's due, the lunches that need to be made, the laundry sitting by the washing machine, and the kids' after-school activities. She gets up, pops a DayQuil, and goes about the rest of her day. Man called day four. The previous day of rest seems to have brought him to the other side. Although he still feels terrible, he has a bit more energy and is able to go to work. By the end of the day, however, he is utterly exhausted. The night is spent lying on the couch, hogging the remote while dozing off and on until bedtime. Mom cold day four. The mom wakes up feeling a bit better than she did yesterday and goes about the rest of the day. Man cold day five. It's getting better. He can tell. He's still wiped out at the end of the day, but definitely on the mend. Mom called day five. She's feeling so much better today that she mentions to her husband how glad she is that her cold is on its way out. He looks at her in surprise and says, "You had a cold? How many of you wives have a man who suffers from a man cold? Just be honest in this moment right now." Yes, yes. It is a terrible, terrible disease where we don't actually want to get well. Actually, I did read an article, and this is true, after doing a little research on this to prove my point to my wife that I suffer from this terrible disease, that scientists have actually proven that men are more susceptible to colds than women. So it's not our fault that we deal with this. It's really God's fault, I think, on this. I'm not sure, but we are more susceptible to this, and so you really should have pity on us. You know, while we smile at that, I think there are areas of our lives, more serious areas of our lives, where we actually like to remain unwell. We would never say that. We would never admit it, but it's true. But today, Jesus is asking this perplexing question, do you want to get well? Because he sees you where you are not well. He sees you with that big box of worry that we talked about a couple of days ago. You know, the boxes that are waiting at your entrance at Fort Wilderness on your way out to grab. He sees you worrying about things again and again and again, and they're crushing you. He just asks you today, do you want to get well? He sees you after the long day of work, of bringing your kids here and there and everywhere, doing your job at work, doing your job at home, so depleted, needing something, needing anything to medicate your pain. And so you go to your thing, whatever your thing is, whether it's the food, whether it's the drinks, whether it's the websites, whatever it is, something you promised, I'm not going to go back there again. And yet you go back there again and again and again. And Jesus asks you, do you really want to get well? And he sees you and your husband who have not been on the same page now for 10 years. What was once a decent marriage has turned into arguments and now has turned into an eerie silence. You're not going to get divorced because that's not what you think you should do, but you're, for all intents and purposes, already divorced. You kind of coexist. You figured out how to do the kid thing. But you just kind of pass each other each day. And there's so much pain, you don't even know where to start. You don't even think you can start. Jesus asks you today, do you want to get well? He sees you trying to control that anger that seems to control you. He sees you in all your doubts and your confusion about faith. He sees you in your thing, whatever your thing is, whatever that area of your life that you would say right now is unwell. And he just asks you this question, do you really want to get well? Do you want to get well? I believe that some of you are going to begin a process of healing today where you will begin to get well in an area, in a way that you never have. See, at the end of this message, we're going to give you a time to respond. We're going to have staff up here to pray with you. And we're going to ask you, and some of you are going to do this. We're going to ask you to come forward for prayer and say, you know what? In this area, I am unwell and I need prayer. I need help. I want to get well. And I believe that Jesus is going to do something special, something unique. He's going to bring you on a healing process that you've never experienced before. And I believe that can start today. And so Jesus asks you this question, do you want to get well? And while the answer to that question may seem simple and easy, it's actually not. At least it wasn't for the person that he asked this of first, the person in John chapter 5. So let's read this story together. John chapter 5. Beginning verse 1. It says this, sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by 5 covered colonnades. Here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked them, and here's our question, do you want to get well? Sir, the invalid replied, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, somebody else goes down ahead of me. Verse 8, then Jesus said to him, get up, pick up your mat and walk. At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and walked. As we entertain this question of do you want to get well, we have to ask this another question, what keeps us from getting well? What keeps us from getting well? And I think there are many reasons. The first of is this, we go to the wrong source of healing. We go to the wrong source of healing. This is what was happening at the pool of Bethesda. Now, you need to understand history to understand some of this. And so, are you ready for a history lesson? Okay, you are over here. I'm going to just talk to you right here. Are you? You're going to get one or not? So let's just pretend. Fake enthusiasm. Are you ready for a history lesson right now? Thank you. I love lying in church and church camp. That's awesome. See, this pool was actually a pagan healing center dedicated to the Greek god of medicine, Asopus. I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but we'll go with it. He was thought to be a kind, gentle healer who came to aid human beings. And it was here at this pool, or actually two pools side by side, that people longed to be healed. And there was a superstition that the way healing took place was that an angel stirred the waters at the same time every single day, and that the first one in was promised healing in the pool. In fact, you may have noticed when you're reading in your Bible that verse 4 was omitted in this chapter. Originally, some manuscripts said this, verse 3, here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed, and here's the verse that was omitted, and they waited for the moving of the waters. From time to time, an angel of the Lord would come down and stir up the waters. The first one into the pool after each such disturbance would be cured of whatever disease they had. Now, the reason this was omitted is because it wasn't in the most reliable manuscripts, and it was actually false. It was a false statement that it was God who was healing people in the water. Instead, this was a superstition. So what was really going on is that those in need of healing would stay by the edge of the water, and once a day, the waters would stir for no apparent reason. And they believed that their only chance of healing, that their only shot of ever getting well, was if they somehow got in the water first. And people are all around this pool. People who are desperate, the blind, the lame, the disabled, the paralyzed. People thinking this was their only hope. And they would crawl, they would roll, they would do whatever it took to be in the water when it stirred. And it is actually true. Those waters did stir every day at the same time. But here's why. In the 19th century, archaeologists found these pools, and underneath where these pools originally were, they found natural springs that fed into the pools, causing the movement and stirring each day at the same time. So what was happening is this man was lying by a pool in a pagan healing center, hoping to get into a pool that looked like it healed, but actually delivered nothing. And we see this. And we think, man, how sad. How sad. How sad that somebody in his pain goes to a pool that doesn't actually heal. You know, I think we do the same. I think in our pain, we often go to pools that may stir a little bit, may offer momentary healing. But when we get out of them, we're back to where we were to begin with in that same pain. So let me ask you, what's your pain? Not only what is your pain, but when you're in that pain, what pool do you go to? I know some people whose pain is isolation and loneliness. So they go to the pool of unhealthy relationships. I know some people whose pain is rejection. And so they go to the pool of always trying to buy happiness, of always trying to not be rejected. So they go to the pool of buying stuff and just going down that road. I know some people whose pain is shame. Shame of what they did in their past. And in order to medicate their shame, they go to the pool of addictions, whatever that pool is. I know some people whose pain is that they always felt pressure by their family members, by their parents, to do something, to be somebody. And so their pool is image management. They try to look a certain way, project a certain image. I know people who related to this, their pain is feeling insignificant. And so they go to the pool of busyness. They schedule their lives so full, they don't even know what to do. They schedule their kids' life so full, they don't even have time to think, because we know that the busier you are, the more important you are. So what's your pain? And when you find your pain, it may not be one of these, but it may be something else, you'll find the pool that you go into to try to heal yourself. See, when we get into that pool, whatever that pool is for us, the waters stir, and for a moment, we think healing has come. But then the waters stop, and we realize that healing didn't actually come, and we, like all the people around us, have been duped. We've been duped. And what we thought was supernatural healing was actually just some springs giving us momentary relief. So we go to the wrong source of healing. Another reason we don't get well is that we don't know anything different. We don't know anything different. You see, so often our struggles where we need healing, the reason we never get well is that we've only done it this way before. It's not that we like it. It's just we don't know anything different. This is what the man in our story must have felt. The Bible says here that he had been this way. He'd been an invalid for 38 years, which was actually longer than the average lifespan of a man during that day. In other words, John is saying this is all he knows. All he has known is not walking. All he has known is rejection by everybody. All he has known is sitting here day after day after day. And if, as far hard as that was, it's what he got used to. It's what he knew. You know, I think the reason so many of us don't get well is that we just don't know anything different. That's why we stay in our struggles. They're so painful. That's why we keep saying, man, I haven't really changed for the last 10 years. I still have the same issues. It's not that we haven't tried before. It just didn't work. We made promises only to break them. We made promises again only to break them again. And we think the pain of getting well is worse than the pain of staying where we're at. So we're just used to it. A little while ago, I was talking with somebody, and he was telling me about his battle with overeating. He's extremely, extremely successful person. He leads a company that every year for the last 10 years, his charts, his graph of growth is up and to the right every single year. 10% growth 1 year, 20% growth next year. He's expanding his company this coming year. But the pressure to do more and be more and to succeed took its toll on him. And it's not that he's always at work. He's not always at work. He's a good dad. He's at home. He loves bringing his kids to different events. He is intentional about raising them in the faith. But the pressure got to him. And his only way to deal with the pressure was that night, after everybody's gone to bed, just get out the ice cream. Get out the snacks. And for a moment, those waters stirred. And every night, he'd go back to it, same thing, started to have a weight issue, started to deal with health issues. And as he realized that this was killing him, both literally and figuratively, he said, I realize that the food I would constantly consume, even though I hated what I was doing with it, that food had become my friend. It was the only thing with me in my loneliness. But this friend was the worst kind of friend. He was a friend that would be there but drain me and suck the life right out of me. And then he said this, and I'll never forget this. He said, I realized finally that I needed to say goodbye to that old friend because that old friend was actually my enemy. And he went on a really path of regaining his health. You know, I wonder if you would say in some areas of your life that same thing right now, that your struggles are like a relationship with an old friend that you don't want to get rid of. You hate your explosive anger, but in some ways it has become your friend. It releases whatever is pent up inside of you, and it's hard to get rid of that old friend. You hate the constant busyness you live in, and it depletes you and your family, but it's become your old friend, constantly validating that you are important. And maybe those websites that you go on, they're so destructive to you, your view of women or your view of men, you hate them, but they become like an old friend, soothing you. Maybe it's the patterns that are destructive in your relationship with your family or your friends, isolating, yelling, stonewalling, whatever they are, but they're like old friends that you go back to again and again and again. And in the end, we don't get rid of these old friends because the pain of doing so seems less than the pain of changing. So we keep our old friends, realizing soon at some point we'll realize that they are actually our greatest enemies. Third reason we don't get well as this is that we feel alone in our struggles. We feel alone in our struggles. Listen to the man's response after Jesus asked him, do you want to get well? You would think that after asking him, he would say, well, of course, Jesus, I want to get well. I've been lying here for 38 years. Instead, he says this in verse 7. This is fascinating. Sir, I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. In other words, I'm all alone in this struggle. Nobody sees me. Nobody helps me. Nobody cares. Now, when it comes to the areas of our life where we need healing, so often the reasons we never get well, it's because we feel like we're all alone. Nobody gets it. And if they saw what we struggled with, they wouldn't want us. Because if they found out about my issues, if they found out how much I'm struggling as a parent, if they found out how much debt I really have, well, I don't know what would happen. And the fear of being found out forces us into loneliness. And in our loneliness and in our isolation, all sorts of anger, all sorts of sin, all sorts of habits grow and grow and grow. And we sink deep into this place of anxiety and worry and darkness. And we assume that we got ourselves into the mess so that we're the only ones who can get ourselves out of it. But eventually you won't get there. Eventually, if you try to keep this all in by yourself, trying to solve all the issues alone, it just won't work. And I say this as somebody who's been there, and somebody who even is in a process of starting to get well, in a long process of starting to get well. 2 years ago, this is my third time speaking up here, but 2 summers ago, I was speaking up here, and I was And Tom and the rest of the staff didn't know this at the time, but I was in a dark, dark place. In fact, last night I had to, around the campfire, I was sitting there with my wife, and I had to apologize for how I treated her 2 years ago up here. You see, my pain in life had always been this issue of not feeling significant, of feeling like I had to earn people's love, of feeling like I had to achieve something so that people could say I was worth something. And so I kept going to the pool of success and workaholism and achievement. I grew up in an amazing family, don't get me wrong. My parents love Jesus. They're amazing models of who Jesus wants us to be. But it's not about a lot of times how your parents parent you. It's about how you interpret messages in life. And I interpreted things kind of messed up. I thought the only way to earn people's love was to succeed and to beat my brother at something. My brother, entering into high school, had a GPA of 3.97, and so I said, okay, there's a 0.03 margin of error there. I can beat that. And so for 4 years in high school, I studied every day. I got home at 3:30, studied till midnight every single day. My parents had to put limits on how much I would study. How messed up is that? Some of you parents are hoping that you would have that problem. My parents actually had to get rid of the love seat that I sat on and studied during those 4 years because I had worn a hole all the way through the cushion. And I beat my brother. I got the 4 point. I got the valedictorian thing. Went on to college. And during college, I was called into ministry. And you would think that spiritual call would change all the dysfunction I had growing up. But it didn't. You just transfer it for, you know, wherever you go, there you are. Some of you will figure that out later. And so I just transferred that same way of thinking into ministry. I went to seminary, graduated summa cum laude, went to Africa, got connected to Ellenbrook, came back, planted a church, and the church grew. Day one, it just exploded with growth. And I thought, man, I am something. People would talk about how great of a success this thing was, and after 7 years of doing that, I was asked to go and be the pastor of Elmbrook Church, which is a mega church in the Milwaukee area. I thought, man, yeah, I've done it. I've arrived. But the problem is that those pools of success and achievement, they don't last very long. They only stir a little bit. In fact, they would stir very, very little for me. Because I couldn't figure out along the way of these things that I had seen God do in my life and in my ministry, I couldn't figure out why I was the only one who wasn't that happy about it. Everybody else seemed excited. Everybody else seemed thrilled. But I just always thought, okay, what's the next hill? What's the next great thing we got to do? Let's go. Let's stop celebrating that. Let's go. Let's charge. And I exhausted myself. I remember 2 years ago, actually that same summer, I was up here and in a bad place. 2 years ago, I came back from Fort Wilderness and we had a baptism service at Elmbrook Church and we were baptizing 200 people. And I was standing in the pond outside of our church seeing all these people being baptized. And while I was excited for them, the only thing I could think was, yeah, there's 200 being baptized. Why aren't there 500? If you don't know, that's messed up. Like, that's seriously messed up. And I wish I could say that this thing wasn't leaking out. This constant, sense of insignificance and not being satisfied in life wasn't leaking out, but exhausted people exhaust people. Hurt people hurt people. And I was hurting people. I was mad. I was sad. I was not a good husband. I didn't spend the time I should with my kids. I didn't know how to love my church. And some people in my life started to see this. I just tried to bottle it up and deal with it on my own. I just thought if I can just get through this season, everything will be different. But some key people in my life started to notice this. My wife, first and foremost. And then a friend of mine, Matt Erickson, actually his son Isaiah, was leading worship this morning for you here. He just started saying, Jason, I think you may need to take a break. So 2 years into my time at Elmbrook, I realized I needed to take a break. That if I didn't, I was either going to leave ministry altogether or I was going to have a breakdown. And so I sat in front of thousands of people telling them, I'm kind of a mess right now. I need to take a leave of absence. I felt so alone. I felt like such a failure. And I didn't know if I'd ever be healed. But I wasn't alone. In fact, I had to do that 4 times that weekend, which my counselor told me would be like rolling through glass, which it was. And also felt like while I was rolling through glass, people were stabbing me and stomping on me at the same time. But during those 4 services, I wasn't alone because backstage, my wife was there. A wife that I'd hurt so much. And each time after I got off the stage, I would just walk back into the back room, and she would hug me, and because she knows me well, she just got out her iPhone and started to play Saturday Night Live clips for me. Don't judge me, it was her, she did it. And I started to see a counselor for 3 times a week. 3 times a week. It's insane, literally insane. 2 years later, I'm down to 2 times a week, so that's great. And what I've started to realize is that I couldn't stay where I was at. I've had to rethink and rewire all of what I know about God and life and ministry. My kids and my wife, and I've realized that I don't actually have to earn people's love. I've already been given love by my Heavenly Father and by a wife who, for some unknown reason, has sat by me and has been the greatest example of love I've ever known. You can't do this thing in isolation. I still can't do it in isolation. I need my wife. I need a counselor. I have a group of people that we have dinner together every Wednesday night. And they know all my junk, like literally all of it. It's scary. There's a couple that we get together every single Sunday night at 8:30. They live in our neighborhood. And there's been days over these last 2 years where I actually told them, I'm not coming down. I'm too mad. And they physically walk down to my house, grab me, and bring me to their house. You can't do this in isolation. The journey to healing begins in community, as we even heard earlier today. It can't happen alone, never has, never will. But what will happen in isolation is that your sin, your addiction, your anger, your ability to hide and keep hiding, your obsessive worry, those things will fester and they will grow and they will eventually kill you. We have lost the value and freedom, dare I say joy, in confessing our shortcomings to each other, where we step out of the closet and we say, you know what, this is who I am. This is my stuff. All of it. Deal with it. I know you have stuff too, but this is mine. I need to get well. See, healing can only take place in community. That's why we're going to have this time for you to pray today, because that's where healing begins. Healing takes place where we say, I'm going to step out of hiding. I'm going to risk my reputation here, because it is too painful to stay where I'm at, because the pool I've been going to has not delivered. There has to come a moment in each of our lives where we get really honest and in confession say, I'm not okay. I know it looks like I have everything together, but in this area, I'm not okay. I have a drinking problem, and it's bigger than I'd like to admit. It has its grips on me. I'm not okay. Our marriage, I know it looks good up here, but if you were to be behind closed doors, we're not okay. My son, I don't know what to do with him. I'm trying to be the best mom. I'm trying to be the best dad I can, but I can't figure it out. I'm not okay. We're running around like crazy, doing this and doing that, going here and going there. Our schedules are so full, and we're so exhausted all the time. We're not okay. I keep trying to buy happiness, and I have the money to do that, but it doesn't deliver. I'm not okay. The way I'm living my life, it doesn't work anymore. I'm not okay. See, the Christian community has to be a community where it's okay not to be okay. Where it's okay to say, you know what, I'm not okay in this area. Would you help me get okay? Would you help me heal? It's in that moment of desperation, when we finally call a spade, when we finally have the guts to say, I'm not well, I'm not okay, that the pools I've gone to for healing promised so much and delivered so little, it's in that moment that we finally realize that their only hope, and I know this is the Sunday school answer, but it is actually the answer, that our only hope is Jesus. It's our only hope. You know, I've heard, actually, an old saint told me once, that when you are at the end of your rope, that's where you'll find Jesus. And some of you are at the end of your rope, and you need to find Jesus there. And when you find Jesus there, you'll realize that he offers power where you are powerless. He stepped into that pagan healing center and does not offer healing to this man by saying, let's go down to the pool. No, in that moment, he wants this man to know that he has a power that no other God has. That he has a power that nobody else has, that no other pool has, that no job has, that no bank account has, that no relationship has, that he has a power that only God has. And so he says to him, pick up your mat and walk. He doesn't force him to. He asks him to. He doesn't come in and say, I'm going to pick you up. He said, I'm offering you the power to get up. But you have to choose. But that power is real. You see, because that power defeated death. And that power is ours. And since Jesus picked up his cross, we can pick up our mats. So let me ask you, where are you not well? Maybe it's a circumstance in life that is just weighing you down. Maybe it's a diagnosis that you got or somebody close to you got. Maybe it's a relationship that's falling apart. Maybe it's a sin struggle. Maybe it's this. Maybe it's that. Jesus is asking you today, do you actually want to get well. I'm going to invite the worship team up here. If they could come on up, that'd be great. And they're going to sing a song, and I'm going to ask those who are the staff that are going to pray to line up in front of the stage here. And as we sing this song, we're going to stand, so those who just want to sing along can sing it. But those of you who need prayer, your Fort staff is here to pray with you. For those of you who would say, in this area of my life, I'm not well, whatever that area is, it might be just a tough circumstance, it might be the worries that you have, it might be this, it might be that. Would you come and let people pray for you? And if you don't do this at camp, when will you do this? The song we're about to sing is an old hymn. It was written by a man named Horatio Spafford, who lived in the late 1800s in Chicago. He was a very, very wealthy man. But he soon started to find tragedy in his life. At just 4 years old, his young son caught scarlet fever and died. His wealth was lost a year later in the Chicago fire because most of his wealth was in real estate. 2 years after that, after he had kind of rebuilt his wealth, he wanted to take a vacation to London with his family, his wife and four little girls. And just at the last minute before going on the ship to go across the Atlantic, he had to pull back because he had a business meeting that came up. And so he said to his wife and girls, just go ahead without me. I'll meet you there in a couple weeks. On the voyage to London, his wife and four girls were on this ship and it collided with another ship. 226 people died that day, including his four little girls. His wife made it to London and sent a note back to her husband, I don't know what to do, and Horatio just said, I'm coming for you. He wasn't well. On the trip to see his wife, as he was on that ship, the captain told him, this is where the accident happened. And as he was there, in that space, he wrote these words, when peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrows like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, thou hast taught me to say, it is well, with my soul.